Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
There's no doubt about it. Christianity has a rival in American society. It's not Islam, although Islam is something of a rival. It's not atheism, although you could call that something of a rival. It is, in fact, a different religion, a religion that, well, is still kind of shaping up. It's difficult to know what to call it. Let's just call it what we've called it up to this point, the sexual revolution. It has saints of its own. It has its own dogmas that it refuses to lay down or compromise. And it really is a rival religion to Christianity. Maybe Christians need to decide which of the churches they are going to be members of, either Christianity or the new paganism. Joining us to talk about the dogma of the sexual revolution on this Thursday afternoon, Mary Eberstadt. She's a regular guest, senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute, author of the books It's Dangerous to Believe and How the West Really Lost God, and a recent column for First Things titled The Zealous Faith of Secularism. Mary, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
In your recent First Things piece, you highlight some recent books that have come out, Anthony Esalen's Out of the Ashes, The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher, and several others. They seem to be addressing a common problem. What would you say it is?
Well, it was remarkable, Todd, that in 2017 alone, a whole slew of books came out, including the ones that you've mentioned, all of them talking about our post-Christian moment or our ex-Christian moment. There was a sense that was shared by all of these authors that Western civilization has actually changed elementally during our lifetimes, really during the last few years especially. And what I'm saying in the First Things essay is that these authors are right. I'm proposing a friendly amendment to what they're all saying. And my friendly amendment is that what's happened is that secularism itself has developed the equivalent of a religious faith, a brand new faith that mimics Christianity in many ways and that is rooted in one thing, which is the sexual revolution. And that's what I try to unpack in the course of the essay.
So first of all, let's kind of define our terms. Sexual revolution means a lot of things to a lot of different people. Some consider it a positive for American culture and society. How would you describe this thing called the sexual revolution?
Well, I think to put it in neutral terms, what we're talking about is the revolution that began with the approval of the birth control pill in 1963, which effectively meant that contraception was now available to everyone, that is specifically women. And of course, this was greeted as a liberating thing by many people, as you point out, especially by feminists and others who saw in the pill the possibility that women could finally be like men and have careers and not be as beholden to the home, et cetera, et cetera. In some ways, all of this has come true, but some other things have also come true. Society has grown so dependent upon contraception that to question its fallout in any way is to put yourself in a category most people wouldn't want to be in. And yet, I think there isn't much doubt that contraception has had a lot of negative fallout that we could talk about elsewhere, but specifically it has also given rise to a series of beliefs that are like religious beliefs in that they cannot be questioned without risk of ostracism. And that's what I mean when I'm talking about a secularist, quasi-religious faith. So, for example, in the essay I talk about figures who cannot be questioned, who are part of this faith. Margaret Sanger, for example, who was a eugenicist, who believed that Black people and others she regarded as inferiors should have their numbers kept down, and who worked with Black ministers to ensure that this would happen. You know, these are the kinds of beliefs that are very out of order today, but the fact that she is a patron saint of the sexual revolution means that she is not questioned. And similarly, with Alfred Kinsey, who authored those famous reports on human sexuality, and who was also, in his personal life, judging by the biographies, someone who offended in the workplace, shall we say. I'm trying to keep it clean because we're on the air, over and over and over again. Now, again, if he were anything but a patron saint of the sexual revolution, his behavior and his legacy would look very different now. He would be up for criticism. But because he is tied to the sexual revolution, he's not. And there are many more examples that I walk through in the essay of how a special kind of status is given to people who are seen to be fundamentally connected to the sexual revolution.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest on this Thursday afternoon. We're talking about the dogma of the sexual revolution. Senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute. And when we come back, she refers to it as the paganization or the re-paganization of society. Why is that?
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the dogma of the sexual revolution with Mary Eberstadt, senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute and author of the books It's Dangerous to Believe and How the West Really Lost God. She's written a recent column for First Things titled The Zealous Faith of Secularism. A little bit later, we'll talk about the consequences of fostering an anti-male culture. Joy Pullman of The Federalist will be our guest. Mary, you refer to this move as the paganization or the re-paganization of society. Why is that?
Well, I don't think there's much doubt that America was once a much more religious country in the sense of people participating in religious denominations, going to church or to other, you know, religious establishments regularly, etc. There has been a sharp rise, especially in younger people, of those who claim no religious denomination at all. So in a way, I think we could argue that paganization is the natural state of things and that Christianity is an interference and that other religious movements are an interference in that state of things. But rather than describe our moment as post-Christian, which I think prejudice is the case, I would prefer the term repaganizing or neo-pagan to capture what's going on out there, because that doesn't seem to imply that we've entered a time from which there is no retreat backward.
You cite a couple examples, beginning with, as you say, the scene on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court after the announcement in 2016 of Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstadt, that decision having to do with the Texas abortion clinic. What was the case, and what did we witness there?
Well, in effect, that case was decided in a way that made abortion easier to get. And the result of that decision was something truly remarkable. A massive demonstration on the steps of the Supreme Court and spilling out from it of people, mostly women, who were so elated about that decision that they were actually dancing and crying and waving their arms in the air. And there's really no other way of describing it. And it wasn't just that demonstration. Twitter was also lit up with people, mostly women, from around the country, crying at what they believed was this great success, again, in the throes of what looked like some kind of religious transportation into another realm. And it was really that event that got me thinking about just how much like a religion today's secularism is.
What did you witness at the now famous Women's March that followed the inauguration of President Donald Trump?
Well, that's another example, I think, of where we see the religious character of this kind of secularism. So what was the women's demonstration? Well, it was a demonstration, you know, great many women from all over the place. But the demonstration wasn't about the usual things that politics consists of. It wasn't about employment. It wasn't about immigration, foreign policy, war. It was about one thing only, which was, again, rooted in the sexual revolution. If you think about the hats that the women wore, for example, and what those were called, that makes pretty clear that this is all about sex. This particular form of opposition to even the president's inauguration was really all about sex. The signs were all about sex. And for that matter, the only women's group that was not allowed to formally sign on with the Women's March was a pro-life group. So again, this shows that abortion has become central to politics in a way that nobody could have predicted, even as of Roe versus Wade. It's become what I think is the equivalent of a central sacrament in this new church of secularism.
It's the subject, if there is a subject in the sexual revolution that seems to be most sacred of all.
Yes, and people who are believers in that church of secularism routinely use the word sacrosanct to describe their attachment to abortion on demand. It's what they want in their politicians. Hillary Clinton, I believe, used the word sacrosanct to describe her own commitment to keeping abortion on demand, you know, available to all. So this religious language comes up too, and it tells us something. It tells us that people have these very theological attachments to this new church of secularism. So secularism has become something very different from what it thinks itself to be. You know, secularists often say, well, it's just that they don't believe in God. They don't believe in organized religion. But they do believe in something very much. They believe in this theology that has grown out of the sexual revolution, and they excommunicate people who don't share that theology.
In that vein, talk about the hostility that we witnessed during the Women's March toward any kind of Christian idea of life or the protection of life or of Christian morality with regard to sexuality.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting, Todd. So essentially, if you look at the attacks on Christianity today in Western countries, not just in the United States, these attacks are all grounded in the same thing. So in other words, if you say, well, I'm a Christian, I don't believe in stealing, no one's going to drive you from the public square, right? If you quote from the Song of Songs, nobody's going to say that you should be shouted down on a campus. There is only one thing about Christianity that is making it controversial among secularists across Western civilization, and that thing is Christianity's insistence on a traditional moral code, particularly a traditional sexual moral code. So when we see the kind of hostility that we see in the public square today toward the expression of traditional Christian beliefs, it is all coming from the same place. It's coming from a defense of the sexual revolution, according to which Christianity can't be tolerated because Christianity has problems with that revolution.
You had kind of mentioned the pantheon of saints that occupy this new religion that's rooted in the sexual revolution. And you had mentioned Margaret Sanger. I've always wondered, and I wonder what you think about this, Mary, whether or not her fans, her 21st century fans, are ignorant of what she actually said, or do they know full well what she actually said and are simply whitewashing her ideas?
I think enough of them know very well what exactly she stood for and what she said. I mean, we're not talking about anything that can't be found by Google. We are talking about a very well-established record of her affinity for eugenics and social Darwinism and stuff like that that was actually a lot more popular when she was around than it is today. So I think, again, she's regarded as a religious figure. She's put in the same category as, say, a Christian might consider a prophet of the Old Testament who committed various sins but was nevertheless important to the faith. I think that's the kind of category that Sanger is in, that Margaret Mead is in, and that a lot of other secular figures are in the context of this new church.
Another is Alfred Kinsey. Who is this for those who may have forgotten the name?
He was a researcher who presided over some very famous research projects, let's say, concerning human sexuality. He is the reason that people now believe that all kinds of sexual practices are normal and endemic to human beings across history. His research model was very suspect. He allowed some of his subjects to commit sexual acts, what we would call sexual crimes, on children, including infants. All of the stuff that he wrote about children's sexual response was based on experiments that would almost certainly have landed him in prison, were they conducted today. So again, we have here a very odious set of practices. And again, I can't go into all of them on the air. But the point stands. It is that if he were in any other context, if he were anything other than someone who helped to normalize the sexual revolution, then we would see him very differently. But again, secularists will not take back his sacrosanct status.
You had said earlier that this kind of neo-pagan religion, as it's manifesting itself in American society, in many ways parallels Christianity. What do you mean by that, Mary?
Well, it is absolutist about its core beliefs. It has, we've talked about some of the figurative saints of the revolution. There are also the demons and the sinners, and those would be people like those who defend traditional morality or, you know, those who won't back down from calling themselves Christian. So there are, in all of these very interesting ways, there's a kind of pantomime by this secularist church of Christianity itself.
You say that traditional believers need to distinguish the competitive character of this new religion from the cooperative qualities of other more familiar ones. What are you talking about there?
Well, it's taken a long time in the United States, but people of different denominations have learned to live peacefully alongside one another almost entirely. You know, if you go back to the Puritans, it wasn't like that. The Puritans were hanging the stray Quakers who wandered into their place and others. There was a lot of religious conflict that the Constitution was designed in part to settle. So we, that is, people of traditional faiths, have learned to live alongside one another and, for the most part, not to regard one another as competitors to the death. This is not the case with today's secularism. Secularism does not want to live peacefully alongside traditional Christianity. Secularism wants to vanquish traditional Christianity, wants to leave it on the wrong side of history, as they often say, and put it in the rearview mirror. So this is a very different kind of interaction between faiths than the interactions between traditional denominations in the United States.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest. We're talking about the dogma of the sexual revolution when we come back. She says one of the ways that this new secularism makes inroads is by insinuating itself into Christian institutions. We'll get an example of that after this.
Listen to the best of the church's Christmas music during the entire Christmas season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. During the 12 days of Christmas, Lutheran Public Radio, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
Have you ever wanted to better understand philosophy and its impact on your family, your church, or your world, but didn't know where to begin? Concordia University, Wisconsin has an innovative, free online course for you entitled Philosophy Kata Christan. These six engaging video sessions are taught by noted Lutheran philosopher, lecturer, author, and pastor, Dr. Gregory Scholes. Learn more by clicking the Kata Christan logo at issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org.
If you want to know what it means to be a man, if you want a perfect picture of masculinity, get yourself a crucifix and put it on your wall, because the cross is the most masculine thing that has ever happened.
My dad had told him, you know, I had been praying every time I went to the Lord's Supper, I've been praying for you for almost 40 years. To go back to church. Prayers answered miraculously.
It's Jesus and Jesus alone that saves us from sin, that saves us from death, and that saves us from hell.
When the dark gets darker, the light's going to get lighter. And as evil as this world is, Christ is going to shine brighter in us the more that we hold on to his word.
That's just a taste of the four sound bites that emerged from 2017 for what we like to do at the beginning of a new year. We take those top vote getters in Issues Etc. soundbite of the week, and we present them to our listeners in the first week of a new year as Issues Etc. soundbite of the year. Those are the top vote getters, and tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to play them for you in their entirety, and your vote will decide which will be Issues Etc. soundbite of the year. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. We will be giving away all of the Issues Etc. books of the month to the listener with the best vote for Issues Etc. soundbite of the year. We'll play it tomorrow on Issues Etc. In the meantime, we're talking about the dogma of the sexual revolution. Mary Eberstadt is our guest. Mary, you talk about the kind of radical incompatibility between traditional religions, with all of them having some kind of tradition of mutual tolerance, and that of the new secularism. One of the ways that the new secularism is making its inroads, you say, is by insinuating itself into Christian institutions. Give us an example of that.
Well, I think you can see in the Catholic Church right now, although not only in the Catholic Church, there are people who don't understand that the faith of the sexual revolution is at odds with Christianity. There are people who want to cut deals. There are people who want to compromise traditional teaching. And they may have all the best of intentions, but their primary error, I think, is intellectual. They don't understand that you can't put these two diametrically opposed systems together. What it comes down to, Todd, is that either Christian theology becomes subordinate to secularist theology, or the other way around. So the circle can't be squared, because the Church of the New Secularism believes too many things that are antithetical to the traditional Christian church, you know, capital C or small c.
So in this way, we can look at kind of now the mainline Protestant denominations that have gone the way of the secular culture in terms of what they're willing to affirm or what they're willing to
deny in terms of traditional biblical teaching, they are they allies with the new secularism, or have they been entirely co-opted by it?
Well, I think essentially they were on the front lines of this struggle between secularism and traditional Christianity, and they lost. That's what happened. They thought that they could accommodate elements of the sexual revolution, its suborning of the family, its insistence that sexual pleasure was the highest good in life, and they, the mainline churches, thought they could try to be nice about this, try to be understanding about this, try to incorporate this powerful new set of beliefs into Christianity, and that it would just give Christianity a human face. That is not what happened. What happened instead was that secularism trumped them, and people stopped seeing a need to go to mainline churches without that strict moral code that was holding everything together. And secularism also trumped them demographically, because ceasing to believe in the centrality of the family meant that a lot of people didn't get married, didn't have families, and so the pews were empty as well. So that, I think, is what happened with the mainline churches. They were the first to engage this battle with the new secularist church, and they lost.
They still seem to have not gotten the memo on that, as far as I can tell.
No, I think that's right. I think they're still trying to figure out what happened. But when you dispense with everything that made Christianity hold together as a worldview, and when you import all of these hostile, essentially hostile beliefs into your church, somebody's going to win. And again, I think that's what happened. Secularism won that one.
What has the new secular paganism, what is its picture of the family? What is its goal for the human family?
Well, that's a great question, Todd. I don't think it has a goal for the family. I think it is not really about collective human behavior. I think it's about seeking pleasure first and justifying all the fallout of the sexual revolution by pointing to the fact that now people can engage in any kind of, almost any kind of sexual act they want, that they are freer from social opprobrium than they ever were before, and that now that we have this new world, any step back to the old one would be a retreat. I think that's what they believe. I don't think the family as such even enters into their vernacular, because if it did, it's very hard to see why abortion on demand would be the law of the land.
You say something interesting in your piece for First Things. You say an illiterate peasant of the Middle Ages was better equipped to answer the question, who am I, than many people in advanced societies and in this country. What do you mean by that?
Well, in a way that I think we're just starting to understand, identity politics itself, I think, is deeply related to this church of the new secularism and to the explosion of the family unit. So what I mean in saying that an illiterate peasant had a better answer to the question, who am I, what I'm saying is that he may not have lived very long. He may have had a hard life, but he knew he was somebody's son. He was somebody's brother. He was somebody's uncle, cousin, etc. He had a place in the human community. And as of the sexual revolution, a lot of people can't say all of that. A lot of people can't take their identity from their familial surroundings because, face it, it's modern family. Who is my father? Well, I don't know if I have had three stepfathers by now. Who is my father? Who's my brother? Well, is it my half-brother, my quarter-brother, my et cetera, et cetera? These questions get very confusing for an awful lot of people. And in the essay, I make the point that this is the traditional human way of constructing an answer to that question, who am I? We look first to those nearest to us. We look to our families to supply that answer, and a lot of people can't supply it anymore.
There is, looking back on, or actually looking forward a couple months into this year in 2018, we will be celebrating the 50th anniversary, I believe, of Pope Paul VI's essay, Humana Vitae, which was, if you look back on it, positively prophetic in what it was warning against, in what it saw as the challenges to human society. Talk a little bit about the need to revisit a document like that, that 50 years ago saw so much of this on the horizon.
Yes, it's a huge subject, Todd, and it is so fascinating to reread that document now. Because essentially when it appeared, everybody outside the Catholic Church and a few other traditional-minded churches just threw up their hands and laughed at it. And within the Catholic Church, an awful lot of people had big problems with it. Because, of course, it reasserted what had always been traditional Christian teaching, going back to the very earliest years of the Church and defining the Church in opposition to Roman practice at the time. So the Church said, no abortion, no contraception, no divorce, etc. Very strict list of rules that it reiterated over and over across the centuries. Well, the document, Humanae Vitae, predicted what would happen in the wake of the sexual revolution. One of the predictions was that widespread contraception would lessen the respect of men for women. In other words, men would be seeing women more as objects once they were more available. I was thinking of that line over and over in reading about the Weinstein, et cetera, scandals lately. There is just a clear connection of the dots between what Humanae Vitae was predicting and those scandals. So that's just one example of the prophetic nature of that document that I hope we'll be hearing a lot more about in 2018.
It saw the widespread availability of contraception as a watershed moment for any society. And I don't know that there's any way someone can look at the introduction of the pill and not see it as, in many ways, the seed, the little anti-seed that in a lot of ways made the sexual revolution what it is today.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I think whether people are for it or against it, they understood it as a major change, not just in our society, but really for humanity, because the consequences of contraception are now global. The whole question is, how will that experiment, how will that new way of being men and women be viewed in history's eye? How is it going to appear 100 years from now? And I think we are at a moment where the happy talk about the sexual revolution is still the dominant narrative. But the more things happen, like the Harvey Weinstein scandals, and the more people look to the wreckage of their own lives and the confusion of their own lives on account of the way so many of us live today, I think a different kind of reckoning is going to be made about where this has led humanity.
It does show that, at the very least, technology, of which the sexual revolution has made a lot of use, is hardly neutral. Even something as simple as a pill is not neutral. It carries with it and produces, when it's employed, a kind of, as you've said, religious creed that says, this is my body, this is my choice, and an absolutist religious creed.
Yes, I think it started with the technological shock of the pill, but it's gone on to become something much bigger, much more complicated, much more influential, including not only in individual lives, but also at the macrocosmic level, you know, the level of politics, like connected to identity politics, for example, and at the level of history, the way in which this new church of secularism has a non-correcting history and won't let us revisit certain major figures of the sexual revolution. So it's having all kinds of fallout, and I think it's a very important thing to map, and it's a very important thing for Christians to understand that they are in a new world, as all of those books that we talked about in the beginning kept insisting.
None of those books call in any way for a quietist approach to this. I think they would all agree, at least in principle, that the approach taken by mainline Protestantism of accommodation, of compromise, has proved a disaster for not only individuals, but also for those churches as well. What is a proper stance over against this new paganism?
I think first, just being aware of how competitive it is, being aware that there is an either-or choice that we individuals have to make about this. To which church do we belong? We need to dispense with the confusion that we can have a foot in both churches. That, in effect, is what, say, politicians do when they say, well, I'm opposed to abortion because I'm Christian, but I'm also privately, you know, I'm privately opposed, but I will vote for abortion-friendly policies as a public matter. No, that is not sustainable. That's not something that logically hangs together. What they're really saying is, I want to have a foot in my Christian church and a foot in my church of the new secularism. And again, I think this is untenable and should be called out. That's one thing that we can do.
And as it continues to attempt to write itself large over society in the courts, in kind of popular opinion, we've talked about those the waves of the Women's March and things like that, it can be a bit alarming. There can be a very strong sense among Christians that what made Western civilization great, insofar it was rooted in natural law and in a Christian way of thinking about the world, is being slowly but surely erased. What would you say about that, Mary?
I think there are people who would like very much to erase it, but I think it's very encouraging, Todd, that the pushback to all of that is increasingly firm in insisting Christianity shouldn't have compromised itself in the first place. The strongest voices that you see within the Christian churches today are on the small O Orthodox side. Again, like those books that we talked about that I've listed at greater length in the essay and First Things, I think precisely because things have gotten so hostile out there, there is a new understanding and a new kind of backbone growing into traditional Christianity, and I think that's a very good sign.
Mary Eberstadt is Senior Research Fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute. She's author of the books It's Dangerous to Believe and How the West Really Lost God, and a recent column for First Things titled The Zealous Faith of Secularism. You can read it and purchase her books at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Mary, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Joy Pullman of The Federalist will be with us on the other side of the break. She has written a piece titled, Rather Than Banding Together to Kill All Men This Year, Women Should Learn to Love. We'll talk about the consequences of fostering an anti-male culture.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Answering objections defending the faith, evolution or creation, transgenderism and homosexuality. These are some of the issues addressed at the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 3rd at Faith Lutheran Church in San Antonio, Texas. Learn more at worldviewsa.org. This conference features Issues Etc. guests Dr. Jan Lohmeyer and Pastor David J. Weber. The San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 3rd, worldviewsa.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
This is Pastor Tyler Arnold at Christ Lutheran in Platte Woods, Kansas City, Missouri. We are privileged to serve our Lord in word and sacrament through the historic liturgies of the church. Do join us for divine service at 8 and 10:45 and adult Bible study and Sunday school at 9:30. Each Wednesday evening, we have Vespers at 7 p.m. Our address is 6700 Northwest 72nd Street, or call us at 816-741-0483. You can find us on the web at ChristLC.net. Come and be our guest at and with Christ.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. EdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at EdGruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.